Coming today on Negotiate Your Best Life with Rebecca Zung.
It diminishes the trust we have in you altogether once we're caught in a lie. So the calm and continued exposition of what is going on by the attorney, and sometimes you got to remember, it took you a minute to figure out that he or she was a narcissist to begin with. And it's going to take the judge a minute as well.
So the big questions are these. How can we navigate and negotiate every situation in our lives, in our career, in our businesses, in our relationships, and even with ourselves for our own self-worth? In other words, what if you could win every time and have no losers? Let's face it, we're not negotiating just to buy a car or for a pay raise. We are negotiating for living in every aspect of our lives. How can we do that powerfully, successfully, and victoriously? Those are the questions, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Rebecca Zung, and welcome to the time where you negotiate your best life. Welcome to another episode of Negotiate Your Best Life. I'm Rebecca Zung. It is my thrill and my honor to have her honor here with me today, Judge Lynn Toler, best known as the judge on the television series Divorce Court, where she presided from 2006 to 2020. That's a long time. She is now the co-host on Marriage Boot Camp. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And she went to Harvard and Penn for law school. She's authored two books. She's absolutely incredible. And we are going to have an amazing conversation. Welcome, Judge Lynn Toler.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here and thank you for having me.
Thank you. So I am doing some research. As you know, my community is people who are dealing with narcissists, even in, you know, whether it's in business or divorce. A lot of people are dealing with it in divorce. I was fascinated to learn that you've actually had to deal with that. You've had your father was bipolar. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, having some kind of identifiable mental health issue always puts you in a category of people that other people don't understand. And narcissism is one thing, bipolar is another thing. But what you have to do is understand the nature of the thing that you're dealing with. To expect someone who is bipolar or narcissistic to engage with you in a manner that other people would engage with is going to set up an expectation that will necessarily leave you disappointed. So what you need to do is understand what that particular thing means in that particular circumstance and understand what works with them. Not what should work, or not what people should do, but what works with them. And then you work with that. For instance, with my father, there were certain things that you could say to him that will give you a couple of extra seconds to leave the room or whatever it is you needed to do to deal with it. So it's to understand is to have power, even though you don't understand the behavior in and of itself. To understand it as a function of whatever mental health issue they have is power in your pocket.
So, I love that. There's a couple of things that went through my mind as you're saying these things. One of the things that came up when I was doing the research of you is you were talking about whether or not you think people actually know that they're mentally ill. Do they know if they have a problem like narcissism or whatever it is? What do you think?
Many don't. Many don't. I think these days more do because we are more apt to speak about it and talk about it, and it has less of a stigma, even though the stigma is still great. Now, with a narcissist, you are less likely to get that kind of introspection because one of the key elements of being a narcissist is that you're not introspective, that you don't have any. So that's not going to happen. But no. Like bipolar, you can, you, yeah, okay. okay, that's what it is. That's what I'm dealing with. There's medications, there's therapies, there's, you know, there's up, there's down, and there's a way to deal with them. But narcissism doesn't lend itself to self-knowledge.
No, it does not. No, they're probably the worst ones for that.
Oh, absolutely.
Frankly. Yes. Have you seen a lot of narcissists in dealing with your cases as a judge?
I did. And I used to call them, we didn't talk about narcissism back in the early 90s, which is when I became a judge in Cleveland Heights. It was a criminal judge. I used to call them people with persistent personalities, because I ran into this certain segment of the population where their personality was so extraordinarily persistent that they had to win every argument, either it was a neighbor or a wife or something, every argument all the time. No, you know, they were just, their personality was so persistent. So that was my alliterative way of describing what
PPP
now I
before
see as a
PPP.
Right, exactly.
So do you think, I'm just thinking, when you say people with persistent personalities, in a lot of ways, persistence actually helps people get somewhere, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. So, I meant persistent personality, and it was a very defined phrase and term, because persistence is how you get to where you and I are, which is doing things that we love.
Well, yeah, but there's a school of thought out there that narcissists actually are oftentimes very successful. And why is that? Probably because they're extremely persistent, right?
Right, exactly. And, you know, everything that you have emotionally and mentally, it has a good side and a bad side. You know what I mean? It can allow you to do certain things. My father's bipolarity allowed him to, when he was manic, engage in some very positive things, because he simply was unafraid when he was manic and he could do anything.
Interesting. So I want to get into all the court stuff, but I also want to ask you sort of a background question, because a lot of the people who follow me and watch me, who are part of my audience and my community, are dealing with massive amounts of depression and anxiety because they have been dealing with somebody who's been basically abusive. It's very, very traumatic. And you have been actually very open, surprisingly open, but wonderfully open in a lot of ways. It's so very inspirational about the struggles that you've had with both of those, depression and anxiety. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you were able to overcome that?
Yeah, I do suffer from depression and anxiety. My sister calls it shadow traits from whatever my father was dealing with. And then there's a strong genetic component. But I raise my hand to that all the time, because if I look at my anxiety and depression, back in the day when you're first in it, you think, I feel appropriate to my circumstances, because the world is horrible. Everything is out of control, and you perseverate over problems, and you feel like that's necessary to remain up in it. But once I named it and claimed it, I saw it as that was something I was fighting against, not the circumstance that caused me worry or anxiety, but the worry and anxiety itself. And having isolated that, I do things to fight that in isolation, separate and apart from the fight I have with whomever I'm dealing with.
Yeah, I think that's very, very good. And also, I think that you had to have some sort of way to overcome this idea that I'm a victim. You know, my dad was this way, this was hard, you know, you went to Harvard and Penn, for God's sake. I mean, so obviously you figured out a way to say, I'm not a victim to this.
Right.
This isn't going to own me. How did you do that?
I can't take credit for that. That was my parents. I was born in 1959, and my sister and I integrated in all white lower middle class.
Can we all just take a moment to go, oh my God, you look amazing?
Thank you. You could always take
a moment. I can't just like let that go by. That's incredible. Okay, keep going.
And so we integrated a school in 1963 and 64. And when we would come home to our parents talking about what the kids said to us or this, that, or the other, they would simply ask, well, what are your grades like? And he goes, I didn't send you there to make friends. I sent you there to make A's. You don't have all A's. I don't want to hear about it. And my parents, because my father was born in 1990, my mother was born in 1930. They brooked no excuses at any juncture, anywhere, at any time. And I was raised without the ability to raise excuses. So I don't, because I don't know how.
That's your next book, No Excuses.
Right?
I love that. Okay, so I want to get into the judicial system. I have a huge community, and a lot of people say the judicial system is broken. It favors narcissists. What would you say about that?
I don't think the judicial system favors narcissists any more than any other system that the narcissist engages in. In other words, they take no prisoners and they don't back down. And a certain amount of fight will behoove you or inure to your benefit no matter what system you're in. The system is designed to level the playing field and everybody should have the same rights. It's supposed to be, you know, the young lady with the balance and blinded to who's before them. Simply, it should be the issues and right or wrong. But narcissists can bully anybody and judges can be bullied too. They're just people. But I think they try very hard. First of all, they won't know he's a narcissist off the bat. He or she, that's right. He or she is a narcissist off the bat. So they have to learn that and figure it out. So it takes time. The person who comes in already knows, but the judge doesn't know. So it takes some time to figure that out. And don't get in the habit of trying to one-up the narcissist before the judge and the outrage, because judges will, in the beginning, if they see it, they can take it into account in what they say and what they hear and what they believe and who has the more rational sense about them. So rationality should will out in most circumstance. It won't seem that way in the beginning because the judge needs run-up time.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people all the time that the court system is beleaguered in a lot of ways. Oh. I mean, judges have way too many cases on their dockets, and I tell people that they do get evaluated on how often they get appealed, and what the result is of the appeal if they get reversed, and they also are evaluated on how quickly they move cases off their dockets, and so I think that judges feel a tremendous amount of pressure. Would you agree with me on that?
Oh, absolutely. And the system, to that extent, the system is broken. And I think that we as a society has asked the judicial system to fix a lot of things that it wasn't designed to fix. You have waves of social ills and these waves of divorce and stuff. And the system wasn't designed for that. It was designed for the peculiar, odd thing. And now everybody's running to court all the time. So, It is an overwhelmed system. No doubt.
I mean, you know, depending on whatever the filing fee is, $400 or whatever, my husband always says anybody can file anything if they have $400 burning a hole in their pocket.
And they do.
And then they do. And the other thing that is that I'd love for you to speak on is I talk often about the difference between divorce law and divorce justice. Right. You know, and that is, you know, judges are tasked to apply the law. Yeah. That's their job. That's your job. They're not tasked to, you know, punish somebody because they cheated, because, you know, they left the other person or something like that. Can you talk more about that?
I'm going to say something about my bias. I think the legislator punted a little bit. Especially in community property states where that's not our job to say who was right and who was wrong. Some states have gotten the idea of marital misconduct, which I'm sure you know about, when, you know, I've spent all my money on my mistress. And so that won't be, you know, so you can make some accountability for bad behavior. But for the most part, the justice system is not interested. It is no fault. And it is simply an unwinding of economics and property, and it is unrelated to the conduct that caused the crisis in the first place. So you have to get next to that in the very, very beginning, especially if you've been dumped upon in the process of the marriage.
Totally, totally. I mean, I will say, and I'd love to get your opinion on this too, I tell people all the time that no fault simply doesn't, it means that you don't have to prove fault in order to get a divorce, right? So, but it doesn't mean fault never matters. I mean, I tell people that judges are humans. And so if you shock the judicial conscience, you know, you can, the judges can develop a bias.
Yeah.
Because they're making decisions about who to believe or not. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, we are making decisions about who to believe. And I will cop to another concern that I have about the system is I think judges need to be better trained to separate themselves from their own emotionality. You know, it's like I was 34 years old when I took the bench. They gave me a robe and set me in the chair and said, good luck to you, sweetie. And I learned throughout the time there that I had to separate how I felt about something because it may be a function of something that's happened to me personally. Because as like I think Benjamin Cardozo said, it's like the waves of emotion don't just get up and pass the judges by. We do feel things and we have to be able to separate how we feel and how what we are seeing makes us feel from what we are really doing, what we really need to do.
Yeah, but it's not always easy, right? Because
it's never easy. Yeah, because your emotions are so close to you and you feel far faster than you think. And if you are, it's almost impossible to eradicate your emotional response to everything. But I think that given better training, I think the police and judges, we can deal with our emotional biases, prejudices, fears in order so we don't pass them along or we don't see them through the prism of those peculiarities or peccadillos.
Yeah. So a lot of people are concerned that the narcissist is going to lie to the judge over and over again. And I've seen them lie.
Right.
And I've seen them get away with their lies.
Right.
And, you know, there have been times when I've seen them say one thing and then 20 minutes later on the stand say something different. And yet the judge ruled for them. I mean, as a lawyer, it can be very frustrating myself as well. You know, and I think, did you not just notice the inconsistency over there? Like, what's going on? But a lot of people are concerned. And so I would love for you to weigh in on what advice you would give to people who are going, I feel like I can never win because they're just going to lie.
Hopefully most judges will catch, you know, because you, if especially if you lie early and we catch you, we don't, you know, it diminishes the trust we have in you altogether once we caught in a lie. So the calm and continued exposition of what is going on by the attorney, and sometimes it you got to remember, it took you a minute to figure out that he or she was a narcissist to begin with. And it's going to take the judge a minute as well.
Oh, that's so true. That's a really good point.
You see what I'm saying? When you met him and married him.
That's so true. What a really good point. That is such a good point.
Coming up, more on Negotiate Your Best Life with Rebecca Zahn.
There's a lot of reasons you can lose emotion, and not necessarily be a function of a factual determination made in favor of the narcissist and against you. There could be legal reasons why.
When it comes to the safety of a child in a divorce case involving alcohol abuse, there is no compromise. Take back power, strength, and truth from the narcissist in your life with documented proof of sobriety. SoberLink's alcohol monitoring system is the most convenient, reliable, and reasonable way for a parent to provide evidence that they are not drinking when a child's safety is at risk. SoberLink's real-time alerts make it easy to negotiate with any party. Judges can rest assured that the child is safe. Attorneys get court-admissible evidence of sobriety, and both parents have empowerment and peace of mind. Get an exclusive $50 off your device by emailing info at soberlink.com and mentioning Negotiate Your Best Life podcast. Are you struggling with how to negotiate and win? Maybe you're dealing with a personality that's particularly challenging, like a narcissist or other high conflict personality, and you're feeling powerless. Make sure to download my free Win My Negotiation cheat sheet at www.winmynegotiation.com.
Take a listen to our archive, where you can listen to more episodes that show you the path to how to negotiate your best life.
We can't determine what happens to us. Life happens. Some people are brought up like I was in a great home and, you know, all the best instruction and, you know, loving family and everything else. Other people come from a broken home. And some people get sick, have an accident. Things in life happen. The career doesn't work out. What we had planned or hoped for doesn't take place. And those are beyond our control. But what is in our control is the choices we make regarding what happens to us. Right? Dad said that it's always better to respond than to react.
And now we return to today's show.
You know, and what I tell people to do is, you know, create summaries of their lies and inconsistent statements, you know, like have a text message that says this on one day and another thing that says this. And it makes it easy for the judge to go, oh, okay, I can see the story here.
Right.
You know, so would you agree with that? That's helpful.
Oh, absolutely. Consistent papering of what is occurring and to put it in, because you 20 minutes on my docket today. So if you put it in, if it's just all over the place, I can't get there with you. But if it's concrete for me, I can get there.
Yeah, that's perfect. I love that. And so, okay. So here's another question that I get a lot. People think the judge, they've been in front of the judge a couple of times. Maybe it's been on a discovery motion, or maybe it's been on a motion to compel or a motion to enforce an order or something like that. And the judge has ruled against them. So now they think that the judge is favoring the narcissist, that they're biased. They want to get rid of the judge or whatever. What would you say to that?
Always talk to your attorney first, because there's a lot of reasons you can lose a motion, and not necessarily be a function of a factual determination made in favor of the narcissist and against you. There could be legal reasons why it is. And so really talk to your attorney, and talk to your attorney with the understanding that you're trying to determine what it was that made the motion unsuccessful on your part, because you'll go first to the thing that bothers you the most, which is their narcissism. But you have to be able to really understand. Sometimes you lose a motion because of the legal particulars of it, and sometimes it's because of the lie the narcissist told. But in order not to get consumed by that, you have to really listen to your attorney and come to their attorney with a clear head about, I'm going to accept what he or she is telling me about the reasons that our motions were denied or granted.
And it's not always the end of the story either.
Nope.
I mean, because, you know, as you go in front of the judge more and more, oftentimes it gets turned around. Oftentimes the judge
patterns
realizes,
emerge.
Say it again.
Patterns emerge.
Exactly. Exactly. And the judge starts to see. But it's really hard. And I want you to speak to this as well, which is, you know, if somebody just comes in and says that person is a narcissist, what would you say to that?
I need evidence. I don't need conclusions. And I think that some people do come up with that person's a narcissist, and they could be a jerk or a fool. You know, they're different levels of jerkdom, and you not necessarily diagnosable just because you're some level of a jerk. So don't come in screaming the concern of the day. Narcissism isn't the concern of the day, but it's the new.
It's the word du jour.
Yeah, it really is.
And everybody's saying it. And so, and what I tell people is that you know, it's almost like two kids fighting, you know, like if you're a parent and both kids come in, she started it. No, she started it. No, she's the jerk. No, he's the jerk. But the judge is just like, oh, both of you stop it.
So don't come in here saying, making diagnoses, because, you know, don't come in crazy. Come in calm with me. If you come in all wild and out with all of the extremities, you know, you got to come in cool, because I will listen longer and harder. And if you're normally a rational and calm person and there's some exaltation later on, I will see it more as a circumstance that arose as a function of events, as opposed to tag you with hysterical, crazy dude or chick.
Love that. And that actually brings me to the next thing that I wanted to talk to you about. You are an expert in emotional control, and you wrote a whole book on it. It's called My Mother's Rules, A Practical Guide to Becoming an Emotional Genius. What's that?
That was very cheeky of me. It was a grand claim, but...
I love it. And since you wrote this book, and since I teach people how to negotiate with narcissists, I would love to talk with you about the lessons that your mother taught you and the lessons that you have learned in dealing with people who are extremely difficult, volatile, toxic, you know, use whatever word you want to use. But when somebody is erratic, when somebody is volatile, it's very difficult to deal with them on an emotional level. And, you know, I would say keeping your emotions in check is one of the most important things to do when you are negotiating. Would you agree with me on that?
Absolutely. Part of a narcissist's power is the ability to destabilize you. That's part of their power, just to upset you and make you wobble. So I always think of my emotional life as separate and apart from my functional life, from my physical life. And so even in the midst of craziness, you got to have 15 minutes a day doing exercise or something joyful where that person is put into the closet because he cannot or she cannot live in the forefront of your mind all the time, because he or she will be working against you all of the time. This is an unwinding of a past life. It is not your present. You know what I mean? It's transitional in nature. And you have to make sure that you cradle your emotionality and how good you feel consciously. You got to make it the pursuit. It's from 7 to 8. I'm going to do whatever it takes, not whatever it takes, but I'm going to feel better. I'm going to do things and live and be in the moment and not simply be a divorcing person.
Yeah. I also teach people how to negotiate in business as well. But, you know, regardless of who the person is that you're dealing with, if they're a narcissist, they know how to prey on your emotions. They know how to trigger you. Right. So what would you say to somebody who is in the moment, mm-hmm. they're in the mediation or they're in mm-hmm. the arbitration or they're in the courtroom, and the person is saying things to absolutely trigger the other person? You know, you're a thief. You're a liar. You're the narcissist. You know, whatever they want to say to have you go, are you crazy? Are you kidding me? You know, it's like that first instinct to just defend yourself. What would you say to them?
I always say, in any fight you have, no matter who it's with, the first battle is always with yourself. So you go in there knowing what's going to happen. You go in there ready to catch those slings and arrows and put them down. Make it a game in your head. Well, that's one. Well, that's two. Well, that's three. Look at him. Look at me. Not having a reaction. Very calm. Very. Take a look at your neck. Whatever you got to do to get you to deliver an emotional response that'll freak them out, because they're not delivering, because you're not delivering to them what they expect. It's almost a game. Like, I take pleasure in not getting upset and excited with or to people that are trying to upset and excite me. It's fun.
That's so great. I mean, I've often said, like, you know, look at them like as if they're having a two-year-old having a tantrum on the floor. Like, you're not going to go get into it, right? But I like it even better that you're saying, like, have fun with it. Just, oh, there they go.
Yeah, you know what in the middle of issues or problems, somebody's trying to get to me, I always like, oh my God, that is the most beautiful bracelet. Like, what you think of me and what you're thinking is so irrelevant to me. I had time to look at your wardrobe and I ain't scared of you. You're not frightening me. I'm not embattled with you because I like your jewelry. And people like, you know, and if you can send people off their game by being on your emotional game.
And what if people just don't feel that way? What do you think about fake it till you make it?
Absolutely. I lie to myself all the time. I'm not afraid of this. You know, every time before I get on a plane, I got to do a whole bunch of mental gymnastics. I was like, I am afraid, but I'm just going to get my behind on it and go. So I've been faking it till I made it all my life. If you ask anybody who was raised around me, they were just like shocked at what I do because I was extraordinarily shy kid, just extraordinarily. You know, so you can fake it till you make it, and then it'll actually become your reality.
Yeah. Each time you face your fear and you do something that you were afraid of, you get a little bit more courageous.
A little bit more, and eventually it doesn't bother you as much, and you can just do it.
You have said that your mother was an emotional genius. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
She was, and I think it was innate with her. And I think when I was on the bench, that's when I realized how brilliant she was, because whenever I said anything that made a defendant like hang his head and say, wow, you know what, you got a point, it's because I've taken something that she's taught me, digested it, and reiterated it to him in a fashion that he could understand. And I used to talk, and my mother was very good at dealing with my father, who was bipolar. And I remember she told me a story when she was a little girl. Her mother had put her into an orphanage for Negro children back in the 30s during the Depression. And there was a little girl that used to play in the house next door. And mom used to think, oh, if I could just get out and play with that little girl, everything would be okay. And once she got out of the orphanage, she went running over to the little girl with her arms outstretched and said, little girl, little girl. And the little girl screamed and ran away. And mom said she stopped, looked around. She said, you know what? It ain't no better out here than it wasn't there, and kept it moving. And I just think that's how she has the ability to stop and assess how she felt about something. And if it's not borne out, she can put a period on it and do something else. And that's what she taught me.
So what happens if somebody is super, like, emotions have gotten red hot in a negotiation, you know, whether it's something your mother has taught you or something you would know, how would you advise somebody to start to calm that down or bring the temperature down a little bit?
You can always excuse yourself from the table. I mean, and I did this not too long ago in another thing, but it's just, I give voice to, I can't speak right now, I'm upset. I actually give voice to it. Or I exit myself from the room. Or I used to have all kinds of things that I would snap on my wrist, or things that I would read. It's going to be all right. Or, you know, whatever it is I used to have on my screensaver. Are you fixing or are you worrying? There are a whole lot of dumb little things you can do to remind you that this is a moment of time and a piece of history, and you've got a beautiful long life ahead of you, and this is just something that we got to get through.
I love that. And what about if somebody is just being extremely disrespectful to you, right to your face, in the middle of a conversation or a negotiation? What would you say to that?
That was really unnecessary. And let it go. Because people will continue to engage in behavior if they know that behavior will agitate you, if that is in fact what they're trying to do. If it doesn't, it loses its fun.
Yeah. And what would you say is the best way for people to communicate as far as trial exhibits?
You know, I don't know. And, you know, the legal game has changed so much since I was in the trenches. I would, you know, with technology and all, I would not venture a guess on that one. I'm going to leave that to you.
I usually always say email or court approved app like Our Family Wizard or something or email, just because I think that it's they're the easiest for, as far as timestamps and and being able to see the entire communication, and they have a date and all that sort of thing. That's my opinion, just because texts are, they don't always have time and date stamps. They are often, you know, way too long to include the entire conversation.
Just to show you, when I was a judge back in Cleveland, they didn't have text yet.
Oh, yeah.
This wasn't there. None of that was there.
This is true. This is a new thing. Yeah. So, what is the best advice that you would give to someone who is dealing with a narcissist who is, you know, in a situation where they're just like thinking, I don't know how I'm ever going to get out of this thing? What would you say to them?
My piece has a high price tag. And if I got to let go of some money to get some peace, I will do that. I will not let people walk over me, but I will not let that actual, you know, the vase or whatever, you know, the idea that I need to beat him or her. I need to beat the day, and I beat the day if I find some peace in it. And that, you know, they're, make them ancillary. It's hard to do, but your life is about your day. He or she is just a part of your day, and make them ancillary. It is a job. It is hard, but it is doable.
I like that. And what about boundaries? I just had that thought. Like, I teach people to like create boundaries, you know, emotionally, physically, whatever boundary type they need to create. What would you say to that?
Oh, I think it's absolutely necessary. During this lockdown, I have boundaries. I'm not allowed to read emails after a certain time because it's not a good time today. I'm only allowed to consume a certain amount of news. I insert limits and boundaries on what I do so I can be in charge of all of the incoming information, because between Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, you get a lot of emotional incoming from all over, and people are emoting, and they're emoting to the world. And if you're consuming all of that, you're consuming other people's raw emotions, and you don't need to do. So you should limit yourself with respect to the exposure that you have to incoming agitation and irritation.
Yeah, I think that's great. And, you know, I also teach people, like, you know, as far as like boundaries, sort of like tactical responses, such as if they get a long email that says, you know, you're a deadbeat, you suck in every way, whatever. But there's like one piece in there that says, what time do you want to pick up Johnny on Wednesday? You could just like write back and say, I'm in receipt of your email. I disagree with your allegations, and you can pick up Johnny at 3:00 on Wednesday.
And I think that's a very, very good idea, because if you don't buy into, they sent it for a reason. They didn't send it to convince you of that. They sent it to upset you. So if they wrote a 20-minute email, took 20 minutes to write a damning email, and then you come back with, yeah, you can pick them up at 9. That's a victory. You need to put that in the win column.
That is a victory. It is so true. I love that you put it like that. That's so great. So you also have another book, and it's called Put It in Writing.
Well, you know, it's funny. Put It in Writing is a book that I had written with Deborah Hutchinson a while ago, and it was about putting things in writing. But it was before, emails and you know, gotten so big. My latest book is Dear Sonali, Letters to the Daughter I Never Had. I married a guy with four sons and I had two more boys. So I've always wanted to have the kind of relationship that my mother had with me with a daughter of my own. So I put all of my best advice for the daughter I never had in a book.
Oh, and give us some of it. Give us a few pieces.
Gee whiz. Your life is about you. It's about your progress and your process. Your life is it's a book. And you should enjoy every chapter of your book, whether or not there's a dude in it or not. The dude does not need to be in the chapter in order for the book to be good. And you should always, you know, secure your professional and educational life. Lovers leave, education sits with you, and then it starts paying bills.
That is definitely true. And I'm half Chinese and half German. So that means by definition, I have no fun genes whatsoever. But
not one.
It's a very intense.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
It's a good thing. I need some of that.
All right. So give us the name of your new book again.
It's a Dear Sonali, Letters to the Daughter I Never Had. But the one that is most relevant to you is My Mother's Rules, because that's the one that is targeted to adults and your emotional and taking charge of your own emotional well-being.
Yeah, I love that. And I'm definitely going to be including links to all of this in our notes. Where can people find your new show, check you out, follow you on Instagram?
Well, Marriage Boot Camp comes on WeTV. I don't know when it's going to come on again. We just now got clearance to shoot because of the, you know, the new COVID thing. I've got other things in the works. Can't talk about them yet, but I got an podcast coming out. Don't even know what I'm talking about. So stay tuned on my Instagram, Real Judge Lynn, and all of my new activities will be there for you to see.
Love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this. This was wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks for stopping by and listening to this episode of Negotiate Your Best Life. I'm Rebecca Zung. Check back next Monday for more inspirational pearls of wisdom. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, I'd love if you would give it a 5-star rating and tell me what you liked in a review on iTunes. Also, be sure to grab your winning negotiation cheat sheet at winmynegotiation.com. And remember, today is a perfect day to start negotiating your best life.